Hopefully all of our teens have been able to catch up with where we were. Many of you were away last week at Barakal. We did send home last week's message for you and your parents to listen to. If for some reason you did not receive a copy of that, please notify the office. We want to be sure that you have a copy. I want to be sure all of our families and teens hear these three messages on this command, this being the second one. The text, of course, is Exodus chapter 20, beginning at verse 14. You shall not commit adultery. This is the one commandment which concerns sexual purity. And as I noted last week, this is one commandment standing against a 24-hour-a-day barrage of sensuality. Sex is used in every segment of the society at this point in time in our history. It is a sales facilitator. It is present extensively in entertainment. And as Cosmopolitan magazine asserts, you have a right to have your sexual needs met. Some recent examples of how much this has been integrated into our culture perhaps might be examined from the political landscape. Going back to the year 2000, the Republican National Convention selected one of its keynote speakers, that being Ricky Schroeder. Ricky Schroeder used to be a child movie star and later secured a role as an adult in the enormously popular ABC NYPD Blue. The series was the only non-cable weekly drama to feature occasional PG-13 nudity and sexually explicit expletives that would have been used in a typical New York City police station. The RNC at that time was deliberately trying to reach out to baby boomers and Gen Xers who see the content of the show as normal and acceptable in our culture. Visual sexual expression is more in vogue, and for the RNC to select a star from that particular show showed the movement of the culture. But let's flash forward to the most recent election that we just came through regarding the presidential cycle. In 2012, the DNC, the Democratic National Convention, selected as one of their featured speakers Sandra Fluke, a woman's right activist. She claimed her claim to fame was her right to have federal government provide her with birth control for sexual liaisons. She testified before a Senate committee on this subject that while a student at Georgetown, birth control costs could soar to $3,000 or more. And she asserted during her speech that 40% of the Georgetown Law School's female population suffered financial hardship as a result of birth control not being covered by student health insurance plans. Sensuality is now part of the fabric of this culture. And now we have to have the federal government actually provide birth control for sexual liaisons, regardless of the age. Francis Schaeffer's words come back again and again. How shall we then live? As Christians, what is our responsibility? What is sexuality? What is sexually normative for us as Christians? And what do we communicate to our children as acceptable in view of the permissive days that we find ourselves living in? I mean, after all, for those of us that even try to protect our children and their minds from this onslaught that's coming from all these various media sources, even going to the supermarket becomes something of a challenge. Just going through the checkout and the many, many magazines with their pictures and also titles of articles. By way of introduction, I want to note again the law of categories that I mentioned. The Westminster Larger Catechism makes this point in regards to these commands, that they not only deal with the particular sin that's mentioned, but those that are part of the same category. Question 99 of Westminster states, what are the guidelines for proper understanding of the Ten Commandments? Answer, the prohibitions against specific sins and the commandments to observe specific obligations are typical and so cover not just those particular sins or obligations, but all others of the same kind. They similarly include all the contributory causes, means, opportunities, and appearances related to these sins and obligations. We noted that. Great examples of that are Jesus' remarks in the New Testament in dealing with this topic in the Sermon on the Mount. And even says that if you even look at a woman with lust in your eyes, it's as if you broke this command. So this, the law of categories spans out, as far as we look at these, are all of the same kind that they involved. So this commandment touches on this whole sphere of sexuality. Why is the mandate of sexual chastity so important to God that it is inserted into the Decalogue? Today's message will answer this question by analyzing two critical terms, one being restitution and the second being the topic of defrauding. We'll take them in that order. Restitution, the concept is this. It is a giving back to the rightful owner something that has been lost or stolen. That is, making good for loss or damage caused. Exodus chapter 22, beginning at verse 1, makes this point. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owes nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. That is the law of restitution. Essentially, the sense is this, that you are righting the wrong caused. You are doing whatever you can in your power to make right what was done. That's the idea of restitution. And you'll note here that you steal one thing, but the restitutionary process means that there's a paying back of far more than what was taken. It's a sense of going above and beyond to make right what was taken. God, in this sense, is not only protecting, he's not only punishing the guilty, but he is protecting the other person. You have the right here of private ownership. Here it is. The person is wrong for stealing, but also the person's right to have these things is theirs. And so they are to be recompensed for what was wronged. That is the idea of restitution. Now, what we want to note is that in some of these laws, there is an absence of a restitutionary process, an absence in the face of some sins. Consider murder, for example. Under the law of Moses, a murderer was to be put to death without mercy. Even if he took refuge in the altar in a city of refuge, he would not be immune from arrest or execution. Exodus chapter 21, beginning at verse 12. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. So the point here is this, is that God actually institutes 6 cities of refuge, 3 on each side of the Jordan River, so that if a man takes another man's life, what we would call manslaughter, perhaps it wasn't intentional, perhaps there was a scuffle between the two of them, it wasn't murder one, they could flee to the city of refuge, hold on to the altar, the horns of the altar, for mercy. And they would be protected there. But if a murderer goes there who has committed this crime in the first degree, even in a city of refuge, there would be no mercy for that individual. The reason is this. For capital punishment, because an assault on the man is an assault on God. We covered this when we talked about that commandment. God views an assault on another human being. This is why this abortion issue is such a big topic. An assault on another human being in the first degree is considered by God an assault on himself because man is created in God's image. A murderer could not make restitution except in the giving up of his own life. You cannot bring someone else back to life. If there is a young person in this church, part of a family, and let's just say an individual in the community is having a problem with this particular son of someone in the church. This problem continues back and forth, maybe over months to years, and this individual is so angry at some point in time and loses it. No matter how it happens, it happens. This person, in a fit of rage, actually takes this young child's life. And the person who did the crime realizes afterwards what he did was very, very wrong. And actually cries out to God for forgiveness and sincerely seeks it. And God forgives it. But then seeks out the person from this church whose son had been taken. What is offered? Are we presenting extra oxen at that point? Will that make it right? Is there an amount of money that could be offered? You see here, there is no restitutionary process for murder. In that sense, it is a more serious sin, not from the standpoint that it cannot be forgiven. All of it can be forgiven. But the consequences are dire because they last. It cannot be undone. Now, what we need to understand in regards to sexual sin, in this sense, it is the same. Sexual sin does not afford a restitutionary process. Sexual sin is more serious because it too does not afford this process. It is not the unpardonable sin. It too can be removed from God's memory like all others, as far as the east is from the west. But earthly consequences remain. Consider Proverbs chapter 6, trying to bring this point out. The text says, beginning at verse 27, "Can a man take fire in his bosom and clothes not to be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who has sex," here, as the text says, "goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished." And now listen to the reasoning. "Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry. But when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all of the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be content, though you give many gifts." Here is the contrast between sexual sin and stealing. Theft may be righted through repayment of the thing stolen, but sexual sin cannot be made right by way of restitution. So the man who indulged in adultery says to the woman's husband, "I know that this has been wrong. I have sinned against God and in your sight. I'm really sorry about that." Will that do it? Or the boy who says to the girl's father that he has been sleeping with, "Sorry, I took your daughter's virginity. I have brought you some flowers to let you know how badly I feel about that." You see, these kinds of sins have those kinds of consequences. And so the first thing we want to note about this is, for those of us who have participated in these sins, is that there is grace to cover them. But secondly, for those of our young people, we're trying to encourage them that they understand the weight of these things to prevent them from these kinds of heartaches and these kinds of scars. Now, scars do heal. And God's grace does cover them. But why take a path where we would scar ourselves? This is why the sin that took place between Amnon and against his sister Tamar was so serious. You remember the story? It's in 2 Samuel chapter 13. They're both half-brother, half-sister of David. Amnon burned in lust for Tamar, so much to the point that he came up with this scheme that he would make himself appear to be sick. Tamar, in innocent fashion, seeks to wait on her half-brother, to care for him, to look after him. So everything in the text indicates a pure heart. And Amnon seizes her and rapes her. Now, as the story unfolds, what takes place is this. Tamar, realizing what has happened, the virginity state of her life is now lost. She now says to him, "We need to go to our father David and make this right." What she was saying was this: we not only need to make a confession about what took place, but have David give a blessing on the union. Because the status of a virgin in Israel was a guarded status. Women were only in one of three categories. Either they were a virgin or a maiden of Israel, or they were a wife, or they were a prostitute. You look carefully at the laws of the Old Testament that even on the wedding night, the proving of a virginity status was in the law that could actually end a marriage if that wasn't proved to be correct. But as you know the story, Amnon, after having what he desired, hated her, pushed her away. And the text ends in a very sad way in verse 19 of chapter 13, 2 Samuel. It says this: "And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her long sleeve garments, which was on her head, and she put her hand on her head and wept and went away crying aloud." Why? Because there was no way this could be made right. If he would not take her as his wife, what man would want her, according to the law? This is the seriousness of this. We praise God for the grace that we receive, that we can be forgiven of these things. But at the same time, the consequences is what we're underscoring. On some of these points of the Decalogue, the consequences are far-reaching. Sexual sin, once it's participated in, and there's a sense of knowing, cannot be erased in the mind. It's something then that has to be contended with. There needs to be a discipline to be able to put those kinds of thoughts out of one's mind. But if one never encounters it, the effort need not be spent. Sexual sin is more serious because it affords no restitutionary process. This leads us to the second point. How do we prevent this from happening? It leads to this topic of defrauding. It is a basic biological fact that I would submit to you that men and women are aroused sexually in different ways. There's a movement in the culture to try to change this and somehow make it so that it's somehow equal between the two. I dispute that. Men are visual by nature, and they always run the risk of sin through the eye gate. Here you have Jesus' remarks in the Sermon on the Mount: if you even look at another woman with lust in your eyes, it's as if you had done it. On the other hand, women are more susceptible to touch and emotional intimacy and bonding. If you want more information on this, go to our website. Click on resources, and other works that I've done are on there. And one of the things that's on our website is the sexual abstinence portion that's been inserted in the Owosso Public School curriculum on this topic. Inside of it, I've got all kinds of documentation and demonstrations to show how this is this part of differences between men and women are so critical. Now, again, when you're dealing with public schools, I can't get into spirituality. It's heavily documented, probably too much so, because I had to get it through all the echelons of the school boards to be have it approved. But it's a resource. Parents, you should take advantage of it. We know from when Dieter was working in the Problem Pregnancy Center as its director, adolescent boys dripping with testosterone and bombarded by images with sexually explicit culture are all too often on the prowl for contact with girls. They are visually oriented. God has made them that way, but it's an unbridled culture that we're living in. And adolescent girls who in particular do not have clear emotional support and contact with their fathers begin searching for it. And unfortunately, it almost without fail in the wrong way, wrong time, wrong place, and wrong people. They give away their virginity in a heartbeat in trade for male attention, friendship, and emotional support. And only afterwards do they realize that though they kept their part of the bargain, they seldom get what they were looking for. Now here is the pathway to sin on this. It involves this topic of fraud, or what we call defrauding. The English here is to take away or to hold back property rights, or to say another way, to cheat. The Greek word means simply to rob, mislead with the intention to cheat. Now I want you to note how it's used. Mark chapter 10, verse 19. You know the commandments, Jesus speaking. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Do not defraud. Again, the Greek here, also used, translated sometimes as defraud in our English versions, is to be covetous or to be overreaching. That is the term that Paul uses in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 2 to 8. Listen carefully. For you know what the commandments we gave you by way of authority of the Lord Jesus. For this is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, that you abstain from sexual immorality. That is, each of you know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God, and that no man transgresses and defraud his brother in the matter, because of the Lord is the avenger in all of these things. Just as we also told you before and solemnly warn you, for God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. Consequently, he who rejects this is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you. The meaning of these two words that find our term, defraud, in the New Testament relates significantly to the command of prohibiting adultery. Jesus clearly taught that the breaking of this commandment is first accomplished in the heart. It doesn't begin with the act, it begins in the heart. Matthew 5, beginning at verse 27, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now, how does the point of sin begin? Where is the genesis of this? When a female dresses in a revealing or a provocative manner, she is in fact defrauding males around her. She has no right to entice them to have what she's advertising and has no right to do it. This is defrauding. Why? Because men are sexually aroused by sight, and women should give great care to the manner of their dress. Thus the injunction by Paul for modesty, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 7. For God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but sanctification. Young people, why is it that we have a dress code in place here in this culture? Because the culture is saying to you every moment of the day, what you need to do is to accentuate your body more. You either accentuate it by how tight the clothing fits, or you take more of the clothing off in order to accentuate the form and the look of your body. That is the culture. It is exactly opposite of what we just found last week in the sermon when we were talking about Rebekah. You remember that story as it related to Isaac, that when she saw him and obviously felt something for him, instead of revealing more, she covered up more. Her veil went up. Because the point was that there would be a moment when a husband is in her life and he would have the right alone to remove that veil from her. Our younger men, likewise, must be taught that being a man means learning how to control sexual urges and not exploiting them. And fathers are critical in the life of their sons at this point. Let me take a moment on that. They're critical in both ways. Number one, young girls need relationships with their fathers. Gentlemen, you must get into the head of your daughter. I don't know how many times I've heard this. You know, I always went to the softball games, and I always did this, and I did that. And I want to know, how much time did you actually speak with them? How much time did you spend talking with them, conversing? You've got to get into their head. They need a sense of bonding and connection with a male figure. It should be their fathers. And all too often, it's not. And then they look for it in other places. And before you know it, somebody's going to come along who has figured out a way to make a connection with your daughter. And then we're in a mess. Young girls are less vulnerable. They're not totally impregnable, but they are less vulnerable to fall into these kinds of traps if they have a strong relationship with their father. Secondly, in regards to young men, young boys need to be taught as they're moving up towards adolescence what it means to be a man. In the culture, they're learning that to be a man is to almost view sex as a sport. It's something that we need to try at and try harder at. I'm not simply talking here about having the talk. I'm talking about having an ongoing talk about what real manhood is and respect for women and learning that what features do you really want in someone that would be a part of your life for the rest of your life. The whole culture is fixed on skin-thin beauty. Nothing here about the internal position of the woman, seeing her as a total individual, although we can't deny the fact that we're sexual beings. And as I mentioned, I think the church had this wrong for centuries, that it was somehow representing the dark side of humanity. It's not. It's a wholesome, God-given part of human existence within parameters. And the parameters are marriage. Gordon Dalby insightfully writes in his book, The Healing of the Masculine Soul, he says this: when a boy reaches puberty, filled with the powerful physical stirrings of emerging manhood, a father's role becomes critical. If the boy at this point is not called out and away from his mother by the father, those stirrings are overtaken by his natural physical bonding with the other sex. In a convoluted myopia, the boy in later physical maturity cannot look beyond the woman to find manhood, and therefore seeks it in women through sexual relationships. If manhood has never been confirmed by identifying with the larger community of men through his father, he constantly seeks it with women, one woman after the next, and he'll never find it in manhood. Manhood means learning how to control these urges. It means not denying them, but it means they need to be monitored. They need to be looked after. There's a sense of discipline about this. Of course, discipline isn't in vogue in any facet of our culture today. When a male begins to touch or emotionally bond with women, a woman who he is not married to, he is sinning against her. He has no right to touch her in this way, and she has no right to have what her passions are being kindled for. This is defrauding. Defrauding in a sexual way is enticing someone else to have something they have no right to have. Now, this is not a concern for married couples. Listen to how this works. When a wife becomes provocative with her husband, she, in effect, is enticing them to have what is already his by way of marriage. When a man emotionally bonds with his wife and stirs passion within her, he is enticing her to have what is already hers by way of marriage. That's like this is part of Paul's thinking here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, beginning at verse 2. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife, listen carefully, does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, that is not a defense for some kind of stilted kind of view of abuse that would take place in a sexual way within a marriage. That's obviously wrong. But Paul's point is that through the union of marriage, the other person's body becomes the other's, and vice versa. Consequently, what was sin outside of marriage, this sense of the enticement, becomes something that's part of the fulfillment of marriage in the sexual union. But outside, sin. And this is the point where it begins. Do you stop a fire down here when it's already a forest aflame, or do you get it over here when it's the size of a candle? You deal with it when it's a candle. And you have to understand these differences. Ladies, when you dress, you need to think in terms of covering up. You cannot take the position like, "Pah, that's obviously their fault. If they're thinking of me in these kinds of ways, this is obviously their problem." Well, it may be their problem. But if there is some way where you're displaying your body in a way that is troublesome for other males that are around you, and I would submit what's in vogue, 9 times out of 10, is going to do that, you're defrauding them. It's as if you are standing, sitting in a chair, sticking your leg out, and when they come by, you're stepping over it and they're falling on their face. On the other hand, when we have males that are touching or emotionally getting into the head of ladies and women, young girls, and bonding them in a way where all of a sudden their heart is being given over to, they're being defrauded. That's sin. It's wrong. They have no right to do that because this is not their spouse. It is for this reason why so many junior and senior high girls are giving away their virginity so easily. In my opinion, it is that more of our young girls are, if more of their girls are bonded with their fathers, they're less likely to be seeking emotional support from adolescent males, which invariably ends in sexual contact. Exceptions, possible, but they are the exception. As well, fathers need to interact with sons to teach them what manhood is all about. Here are the points for reflection. Number one, the breaking of this commandment involves far more than physical adultery after marriage. At its root, this commandment is concerned with all manner of sexual sin. Secondly, the inability to make restitution for sexual sin means that this infraction of the moral law is more serious. Not serious, more serious because of God's grace. There is grace to cover this. It is forgivable by God, but the circumstances cannot be undone. There's something else on this point that just came to me, and I don't think I worked it into my last message on this. Let me take a minute. The studies show, in regards to the male brain, that when a man is in a fight or flight episode, something that is intense, that whatever that is causing that problem, there's something released within the brain, the chemical of some sort that embeds this more deeply in the memory. God has done that as a protection. If he survives that event, whatever the nature of it, then at a later date, when he's in a similar circumstance, that immediately comes back as a safeguard. What did he do the last time? The interesting thing about this, and this has been documented, is that the same chemicals that are released for memories of males regarding fight or flight episode is the same type of memory process that happens when they view sexual content. That is why this is so hard to get out of the head. Can it be forgiven? Yes. But once it's in the computer, you can't erase it. It becomes more of a burden to be able to have to discipline oneself to put those thoughts out. Now, again, is it forgivable? Absolutely. And many of you struggle to this very day, having viewed pornography and certain images or perhaps other situations that happened with women that were outside the context of marriage, and it's part of the BC days, perhaps, before Christ. But nonetheless, it's in there. And it's amazing how these things come back. Young people, the best insulation from this is don't have it. It is beyond me. If you're a part of this church and you have access to technology and your family is not on Covenant Eyes, of which the owners have made it free to anybody that's a part of this church, that is beyond me. I absolutely do not understand that. The greatest access point of the 21st century is the new technology. Don't be stupid. Be wise. Jesus said, be wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove. Understand the times and protect yourselves and your family. Number three, we may promote sexual sin among us based upon how we act or dress. This is a sin. Stirring passions in someone to have something they have no right to have is a great moral wrong also. Young girls, I know it's not, sometimes it may be the thought, I want to dress this way because you want that attention. That obviously is sin. And some of you have fallen into this out of sheer ignorance. You just kind of went along with the culture. This is how we dress. But I'm saying to you this morning, not among the people of God. I'm not saying that all of you need to buy a burlap burqa. There is nothing wrong with looking pretty. There is nothing wrong with looking beautiful. There is nothing wrong with the adorning of earrings or some kind of makeup. But we need to hear what Paul's saying here is that with all this external stuff, still the most important thing is what's going on in your heart and your soul. But also to be mindful of the environment that's around you. If you want male attention, then dress like the world's telling you to dress. You're going to have it, but you're going to have it for all the wrong reasons. Stirring passions in someone to have something they have no right to have is a great moral wrong. Teens, I'm encouraging you, keep a proper distance from one another. You should be careful how familiar you become with the opposite sex. This is part of the culture that's moved today. When I see kids, they're kind of hugging each other, they get together, they're kind of laying on each other, they talk this way. It's part of the culture. There should be some space, which is safe. It's a good thing. The culture doesn't care about it. But space between the sexes is a good thing. Fourth, sexual intimacy between married couples involves a sense of knowing that is beyond a mere activity. Patrick Miller writes in his book on the Ten Commandments, it is, in this full sense, sexual relations is not simply an activity. It is a reflection of an intimate and loyal relationship between two persons who share their lives together as partners in an enduring relationship. Even where divorce may be the outcome of a relationship, it is not presumed in its initiatives. Faithfulness to one another starts in the sexual relationship, but that's only the beginning of it. Much is often made of the fact that in the Old Testament, sexual union is described as a sense of knowing. One needs to be careful about carrying that particular use of the verb over into all forms of knowing, but it is no small matter that in the relationship of the wife and the husband, their most intimate acts together are characterized as knowing, for in that act whereby the two become one, there is a coming to know that blossoms in countless other ways. That's for marriage. And we have this idiocy in this world that would simply say, well, you know, we have to know that we're compatible. Of course we need to have sexual liaisons. We need to have them, and we need to have them regularly before we get married. Why should I join myself to somebody that I'm not compatible with? That's the blind leading the blind. When we come to the point of making a commitment to somebody in marriage, there is absolutely no way you can know everything about that other person at that point. You try as best you can. You don't know them completely. And that's why when you stand on an altar, you're making a covenant before God to help you honor those vows. That's what that's about. And you learn with the other person. There's a sense of knowing where you discover yourselves together in intimacy that you don't know with anybody else. Finally, loving God means, in part, learning how to possess our own bodies in honor, which is an expression of our love and devotion to Him. We got to begin to see this, that this whole sexual area of our life, that when we're monitoring that, when we're administrating it properly, this is part of our worship. It's part of what Paul was after in Romans chapter 12, when he said that, I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is our spiritual service of worship. And then this, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Why? That you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good, acceptable, and perfect. We learn how to possess what God has given to us. Again, Paul's remarks to Thessalonica, for you know what the commandments we gave you by the authority of the Lord Jesus. For this is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, that you abstain from sexual immorality. The term there is porneia, from which we get the English word pornography. All forms of sexuality that are outside the realm of God's stated law for it to be expressed are covered. That each of you know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God. You think that what's going on today is different? This is the first century. It was as sensual as it was is now as it was then. And that no man transgress and defraud his brother in the matter, because the Lord is the avenger of these things. And just as we have told you before and solemnly warn you, that God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. I am grateful for the grace of God. I have regrets in my life. I have times before Christ that are still with me to this day. Some of you know that. Some of you have known those kinds of traumas after Christ. And we give thanks to God for the grace that emanates from the throne and the gospel that erases our sins. And we hear, as far as the east is from the west, so far has He removed our transgression from us. And that's the good news. but for the benefits of maintaining purity amongst ourselves adults and for imparting this truth to our children and grandchildren, that we might teach, train, and model them the truth in an age of darkness and lies for the purpose of honoring God and preserving them from the scars of this world. Why would we not do that? In Jesus Christ's name.